We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you both back, trapped at your computers. Because I'm sure you haven't had much of that this week.
Well, and I'm sure there are a lot of other people in the world who have been trapped at their computers.
Or just trapped, period.
Yeah.
Well, starting out with passing of a notable person.
Yeah, Todd Gitlin, social critic, and who originally started out as an activist in the early 60s. He was one of the original co-chairs of Students for a Democratic Society. Look it up, kids. And signer of the Port Huron Statement, which was hugely influential in kickstarting the social justice movement among whites in the 60s. Of course, African Americans had been trying to have equality for years before that. But he had become an academic in his later years and frequently wrote in high-end, elite East Coast publications. And he was frequently critical of today's activists, and I didn't always agree with him, certainly, but he always stayed true to his values, and I wish more boomers had done that. So he passed away at age 79 this past weekend, and he will be missed by some people.
So moving on, we had an election just a week ago.
Yeah, you may have missed it if you blink, but there were two school levies on the ballot. I'm not entirely sure why they weren't on the ballot in November, but they weren't. And they
typically
passed.
School levies appear on the February ballot anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So, they passed very easily with 78% and 79% of the vote, respectively, for the operating budget and the capital budget. So that's good news for Seattle schools.
Yeah, very good news, given that the state legislature, even though they had supposedly cured the financial difficulties of school funding in Washington State, there were many shortcomings to the formula that they came up with, especially for urban and suburban school districts, which need so much more funding than what is being provided by the state, just for, you know, replacing worn out buildings and equipment, also for things like special education, for school nurses, for teachers' aides and assistants, just a ton of things that the basic financing formula that the state legislature came up with just does not provide.
Yeah. One other local initiative of note in the state, Ocean Shores rejected a proposal to build tsunami towers. Now, these are towers that people can evacuate to in the event of a tsunami. And it's a particular issue for places like Ocean Shores, Long Beach, that whole peninsula. Ocean Shores is on a very flat, essentially sandbar peninsula, as is Long Beach. And, people for the offshore big one that people are expecting any, you know, millennia now, but which geologists say we're overdue for, there really wouldn't be time to evacuate places like Ocean Shores, which is, you know, it only has about 6,000 or 7,000 people, but if there's one road out of town and, that road is basically at sea level, a lot of people are going to get stuck on the road, and that's assuming people can pack up and leave immediately. So the idea was to build a tower that would be able to survive a substantial tsunami, but local voters didn't want to do it. So there you go. It's on them if Ocean Shores drowns some one of these decades, which it will eventually anyway, because, you know, it's sea level.
With rising sea levels, yeah. But yep, that's another slow motion disaster that is coming down the pike.
Yes, that people are doing nothing about, basically.
Yeah, but to be fair, you know, that's the state should really be picking that cost up to do that. I mean, leveling that on 6,000 people. I mean, we were just talking about the schools. It's similar to the fact that the state has levied the cost of earthquake retrofitting onto all the individual school districts, you know?
Yeah,
that's very true.
And that's just, and again, this is something that, you know, everyone has seen coming forever, and it's just basic infrastructure that the state should be picking up.
Well, there is more than one side to this. I mean, it isn't just they absolutely need towers. I mean, there's another side to it saying, well, when you choose to live somewhere, you're taking into account the cost of a future disaster.
Right.
So, for example, if someone buys a house on the beach and they know about rising sea levels, there's a question. Should they then be able to turn around and ask the state government or the federal government for money to protect that property? And if they can't buy insurance for that home, you know, or the insurance is super expensive, or the insurance is not super expensive, and then there's a disaster and the insurance company doesn't want to pay, there's this question of, well, you know, did the homeowner adequately foresee, you know, that this kind of a disaster was going to be inevitable, you know? So,
well,
it's, I mean, that's a cold calculus, right? When you're consigning 6,000 people to, well, either leave, you know, or risk being buried in a tsunami. But I think that's the calculus that people make when they do decide, well, I'm not going to think about that. I'm just going to stay here because I love this place, you know?
Well, as the former resident of an island sandbar beach city, namely Galveston, Texas, which is prone to hurricanes. It's had 3 hurricanes hit directly in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And every time, you know, the beachfront properties get wiped out, and every time the insurance companies just pick up the cost and it gets rebuilt in the same risky place. So,
well, and then the insurance companies turn around to the federal government and they say, help.
Yes. And they also.
And the taxpayers end up bailing out, you know, or there's a federal emergencies declared, and, you know, taxpayer money goes into reviving those areas. So, you know, there is more than one side to this.
But again, we're all talking, recording this in Seattle.
Right.
We're talking about tsunamis, which are caused by earthquakes.
Yes.
And Seattle sits on, you know, in between multiple fault lines. So,
yes.
We live within a section of the country where we all are going to be affected. And the current estimate right now is 1 in 9 chance of the big one hitting in the next 50 years. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, no. And that is kind of some people would argue that that's, you know, what life is. Wherever you live, there are going to be some risks that you take. If you're living in the Midwest, it's tornadoes. If you're, you know, living in a coastal community, it's rising sea levels. If you're living in Seattle, it's the big one. It's earthquakes. So, you know, the question that anybody voting on an initiative like that is, you know, should I shell out a huge amount in tax money to prepare for something that, you know, may be inevitable, but I just don't know when it's going to happen. And, you know, you take risks anywhere you live. Right.
I don't think the calculus is that sophisticated for most voters, honestly. I think, you know, Ocean Shores has a lot of retirees, and they probably figure, I don't want my taxes raised. I'm on a fixed income. And, beyond that.
And I may not be around. And, you know.
Yeah, I'm not going to live that long anyway. That. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. That is the calculus that people do when they vote.
All right. So, enough about that.
And other than that, there were no interesting elections.
Okay. So, concrete haulers have been on strike now.
No, it's into its third month now in King County. There are 6 major companies that are affected, as well as most major construction projects in Seattle. So if for some reason you notice that that construction project across the street and the one next door and the one down the street haven't been progressing in recent weeks, that's why. Their union is part of Teamsters Local 174, and they're striking over wages and healthcare benefits. Unfortunately, at the end of January, their healthcare benefits ran out with the lack of a contract. So they definitely need support and solidarity from other union members and just general public in King County. Because you cannot say that developers who ultimately pick up the cost for construction, that they're not profitable. They're plenty profitable. They can afford livable wages.
All right. So moving on to this week's police accountability news.
Yeah, a couple things happened this week. First off, the police monitor and Antonio Oftili released his second report on the status of police accountability in Seattle. This one was the report on stops and detentions. And interestingly, he released it just barely a week before the next meeting for the public to comment on. Actually,
he did. I listened to the bulk of this week's public meeting, mm-hmm. and there was multiple complaints about the fact that he released it just hours before that meeting.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
People were sitting there and saying they hadn't even had time.
Where's the report? We haven't read it yet. Yeah, no, that was bad. Okay. Really kind of, I think, shows the contempt that the police monitor has towards the community, which really through its complaints, started this whole process. Without bringing in the community and getting and allowing them to get some kind of satisfaction from the police reform process, this process is not going to end. Okay.
It feels like it's not going to end.
I know.
It's been going on for a decade now. And,
I know. Then you read a report like this, and it says, you know, it says in the report that little has changed in terms of racial disparity. Now, it says on page 4, but interestingly, it says on page 4, kind of right up front, quote, and this is a quote, "Race was not a factor in determining an individual's likelihood of being the subject of a stop or frisk, lacking documentation of sufficient legal justification by officers." So basically he says on page 4 of the report, kind of right up front, that race was not an issue, not a factor.
Well, no, or that they just didn't record it.
Yeah, exactly. And then on the next page.
Which that was one of the complaints originally
in
the reform process, is that SPD didn't keep statistics based on race.
Well, no, I think actually he said, when he's saying lacking documentation of sufficient legal justification, I think he's saying stops and frisks that are not part of a warrant or some other legal justification to stop. So things that are, you know, stopping someone on suspicion.
Okay.
And then on the next page, just the very next page, maybe two or three paragraphs later, it reads, quote, "Racial disparities in stops remained fairly consistent between 2015 and 2020, with the greatest disparities for Native Americans and Black individuals compared to Seattle's population," end quote. So there he states it, you know, this one of the leading complaints of the community is that the police, you know, single people out based on their color for these stops and frisks and stops and detentions. And there he's stating it, well, there's been almost no change from in the last, you know, 7 years. Okay. He then goes on to say that, quote, "determining the extent of racial disparity caused specifically by policing is difficult to quantify," end quote. A statement that really has no meaning, right? He's basically kind of raising this issue of, well, you know, policing itself doesn't cause racial disparity, which is like a non-statement. You know, it's not even part of the topic here. So it's like, why bring it up unless you're trying to bury the issue at hand, right? So then he blames the racial disparity in stops and frisks on income inequality or other, what he calls other social inequality, you know, which really is a code word for income inequality, for the racial disparity in stops and frisks. And of course doesn't acknowledge that this is also a type of bias, what we usually refer to as class bias, right? And of course the report acknowledges that according to Seattle Police Department data, that white people are least likely to be frisked, but most likely to be carrying a weapon when they are frisked. Again, no change from prior reports and from prior years. So really this report that was supposed to look at the status of police reform in Seattle, in regards to stops and detentions, has found, you know, almost no change, almost no improvement, you know, and, that the reform process has not addressed this key complaint by the community that of bias in policing in Seattle. So that was, I think, a very, very interesting report. And that is probably the reason why he only released it just hours before the meeting, is because he didn't want to give the public time to make comments on it and to bury him in more complaints about, you know, here we've been engaged in this process for a decade and this is the best we can do, you know?
Yeah.
But people can still go to the website and you can still read the report and you can still comment on it. It's seattlepolicemonitor.org.
Okay. And we have links to that now on our website.
Awesome.
Easy access. If you go to the website and check out resources. Oh, sorry.
KODXSeattle.org.
Correct. Go to resources, okay. And it's under that tab. So.
Mm-hmm. So, and now another thing that happened this week in terms of police accountability. There was actually not this week. It was a little bit earlier, but we didn't have a show last week, but I didn't want this to slip by. Now, on January 30th, the Seattle Times ran an article that was based on documents that they obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request from Mayor Durkan's office. Those documents show that she asked members of her staff and of the Finance and Administrative Services Department to work on a plan to give the East Precinct building to the nonprofit group Black Lives Matter Seattle King County. And this was in the first week of June, before the Seattle Police Department packed up and abandoned the building, and before activists formed the CHOP by barricading the surrounding streets, and also before council member Shama Sawant suggested that the building could be turned into a community center. Okay. In fact, Calvin Goings, the director of the Seattle Department of Finance and Administrative Services, even drafted a bill to send to Mayor Durkan so that she could review it and then submit it to the city council. That would have given the building to the nonprofit BLM Seattle King County group effective July 1st, 2020. That bill was sent to Durkan's desk on June 7th, the day before the building was abandoned by the police department. Okay. So letters and other documents were exchanged by city staffers regarding this plan throughout June, up through June 17th. Okay. Melissa Mixon, she's a spokesperson for the city's Finance and Administrative Services Department, confirmed that the work was requested by the mayor's office and was not done just at the whim of Calvin Goings. All right. In spite of what Mayor Durkan's staff are saying now. Okay. It wasn't until June 15th, that's a week after the plan was drafted, that members of Black Lives Matter Seattle King County submitted a letter to the mayor asking for the East Precinct building to be turned over to them to turn it into a community health center. Okay, so apparently this raises the question, right, who really ordered the abandonment of the East Precinct building? You had the mayor looking at turning the building over to a nonprofit in the very first week of June, just right after the protests started. Okay. Now, we don't have Durkin's text messages from that time period, and we don't have them for a reason. And these new documents really make it look like Durkin may have wanted to hide the fact that she ordered the Seattle Police Department to leave, or perhaps negotiated it with Chief Carmen Best, whose text messages are also missing, and that they maybe came up with the idea on their own and not as a request from Black Lives Matter Seattle King County, who sent a letter formally requesting it, you know, on the 15th of June, not in the first week of June. So that's really, I think, maybe why those text messages are missing.
And, you know, previously well after the fact, but previously the city had thrown the police site commander for the protest under the bus, saying that it was all his idea and that Best didn't know about it and Durkin didn't know about it.
Oh, in fact, they said we specifically told them not to abandon the building.
Yeah,
I'm like, it would be easier for us to believe that if you had text messages showing that, but you don't, so.
Yeah, and I mean, Durkin was so well known for her, you know, accountability and transparency.
Oh, I know.
That, you know, you pretty much want to take her at her word for everything.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Erica Barnett tweeted, was it earlier this week or last week, that she got a copy of a document that showed that Mayor Durkin had an alternative email address that people could that was given out to special friends of the mayor who needed to contact the mayor, you know, confidentially.
Amazon.
Yeah, you know, members of the business community, et cetera. And it looks like it may have been, you know, Durkin's personal address. I don't know, but
it was a Seattle.gov email address.
So okay, so that
technically
was
it was an unlisted, you know,
unlisted mayoral confidential email address. And again, you know, when you have
these are known technically as back channels.
Yeah, and when you have hidden ways to be contacted, and you're not archiving the documents from that, that's a violation of the Public Records Act. You know, when you're not archiving the data from those confidential government email addresses, that in itself should be a scandal.
Yeah, well, and to be fair, we don't know yet that those haven't been archived. Mm. You know,
yeah, nobody's known to look for them.
Yeah, you know, but, it's not her official email, so.
Well, technically, though, I mean, you'd have to look at the individual public records requests, because generally, one would ask for all communications from the mayor related to such and such an event or whatever, and so then the people in charge of searching for that need to know that the mayor has multiple email addresses.
And has five or six emails.
Yeah.
Right.
And it begs the question of how many email addresses the mayor actually had in addition to this new one that we just found out about. And it also begs the question of who other people in the administration, how many email addresses did each of them have?
Right.
Yeah.
So. Exactly. And, you know, when are we going to see the documentation from those?
Yeah. So. Meanwhile, you know, someone is there like,
yeah, and I should point out too that I think the Durkin administration also did some shuffling of the websites and public facing information during her administration for some of the Seattle government departments. I think also Erica Barnett was complaining that they'd taken down a list of personnel in the Seattle, the Seattle personnel directory. So then it made it so much harder for her to try to find contact information for people working in the mayor's office and other city departments.
Yeah.
So again, you know, there's this thing going on there with former Mayor Jenny Durkin, all about secrecy and not being accountable to the public. And I just find that extremely distasteful. And I think it's a complete violation of the Public Records Act.
Yeah, and in the case of the personnel directory, again, that should be public information.
It should absolutely be public information.
And I know when I was an active reporter, that was my go-to source for trying to contact someone in the city.
Well, and it should be the go-to for anyone trying to contact any city department, right? Just to get basic city services. You need to have a directory like that. But, you know, Durkin decided, or someone underneath Jenny Durkin decided that, well, we're changing that. We're going to take that down.
Yeah.
we don't want anybody
to know we're here.
You can't just do that, you know?
We don't want anybody to know we're paying this.
We don't want anyone to know how to contact. They can call kind of the general line and leave a message, I guess.
Exactly.
And hope to get called back sometime before they die.
Yeah, good luck with that.
That voicemail box is full.
Exactly.
Yes.
Right.
Because it hasn't been checked since Durkin took office.
2017.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, but, you know, we now have a new mayor in, and things are changing, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're not known for your optimism.
I'm not.
The whole tough on crime, you know, chest beating thing is now back in style with Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell this week holding a press conference to talk about his new initiatives to fight crime in Seattle. And then, of course,
we should put new in scare quotes.
right, because then he failed to announce any new specifics about his plan other than to say that the Seattle Police Department will concentrate on crime hotspots in the city.
Every mayor has been doing for the last 20 years.
Exactly.
That's not new.
It's the same old that's been failing, you know. Now, his deputy mayor, Monisha Harrell, confirmed that the mayor had approved a list of specific hotspots, but that it was highly classified information that he won't be sharing with the public. Instead, sounding just like Donald Trump.
Because they're all on the south side.
Yeah, sounding just like Donald Trump, Mayor Harrell kind of blustered and said, the public knows where they are. Most people know where they are. The police department knows where they are. So I don't want to start calling out intersections and calling out streets. And my response to that is, no, I'm sure. But if you have a list, why don't you just release it to the public, right? You know, what are you hiding? Maybe he's hiding the fact that there is no list. Right. He just kind of is patting the SPD on the back and saying, okay, keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, or that they're
all in communities of color.
Yeah. Or else they're all just four or five blocks downtown. Right. That was what I was thinking, because that was Mayor Durkin's initiative, was let's just concentrate on a small area of downtown for cosmetic reasons and to keep the business community happy. My guess is Harrell is, you know, let's not change that.
No, because he got elected by the same people.
Exactly. And in the meantime, City Attorney Ann Davison said that her office will begin to file more misdemeanor charges more speedily and against the more frequent offenders. However, this butted up right against a request by the union representing workers at the King County Jail, begging localities in King County to stop sending people accused of misdemeanors to the jail. The jails in King County are currently suffering under a weight of COVID-19 infections that have sent a huge number of jail staff home and left prisoners in appalling conditions. People accused of misdemeanors who are jailed awaiting trial cycle in and out of the jail so quickly that they ultimately bring many new cases of COVID-19 inside with them, and they carry it back out to the community. In fact, the King County Jail has been reviewing, or the King County Council has been reviewing ways to release more low-level offenders to try to ease conditions in the county jail. So this initiative of Ann Davison's to charge more aggressively and to send more of those quote-unquote frequent offenders to jail awaiting trial is actually a really stupid move. Either
it's a sort of surreptitious way to punish low-level offenders further by making sure they get infected.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but it is pretty bad. And this week, Councilmember Sarah Nelson did two things to prove her bona fides as a business shill. First, she refused to vote for a resolution in support of local Starbucks workers who are trying to unionize as part of a nationwide union drive at Starbucks stores across the country. In spite of the fact that Nelson routinely tweets in support of union drives and labor organizing, that is, I think, probably the most hypocritical thing I've seen in a public official in a long time.
Watch what they do, not what they say.
Yeah. And well, then secondly,
I believe the business she co-owns is also non-union.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And secondly, this week, Sarah Nelson turned her Economic Development Committee meeting over to a string of business owners who complained about shoplifting, litter, broken windows, graffiti, boarded up buildings, homeless people, and other stuff related to the pandemic lockdown. But none of them mentioned COVID-19, of course. Instead, they blamed a lack of police on the street. Nelson, of course, had no new bill or plan to introduce in her committee meeting, and explained that the meeting was to air grievances that are already being aired in the local media, but apparently not aired enough at city council meetings, I guess. Although it's fair to point out that business owners can sign up to testify at any city council meeting, just as any other member of the public can do and often do. They don't have to wait to be invited by one of their own to dominate a specific city council meeting, you know, just if their complaints are really all that bad, right?
In fairness, they don't have a back channel to the mayor now. Or maybe they do and we don't know about it.
Oh, yeah. No, they've always had a back channel to the mayor. We just have never known about it until just recently. So, yeah. So there you have Sarah Nelson, who posed as a pro-labor person to get elected, basically throwing off that mantle and now picking up the torch for the business community.
Is anybody surprised?
No.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Okay. Let's move on to what's cooking at the state legislature.
Quite a bit. There were 2,700 bills working their way through the state legislature. Many of those bills are going to fall by the wayside. And Tuesday the 15th is the last day for bills to pass their house of origin. Here are some of the housing-related bills and environmental bills that have already passed the House and Senate. There are that have already passed at least one of those two chambers. There are a lot of other different types of bills, but this week I wanted to look at the housing-related ones and the environmental bills because those were my two priorities when I saw that the state budget had more money than anticipated this year. I thought, okay, human infrastructure like housing for the homeless, that's got to be a top priority, and environmental and things that address environmental issues in Washington State, I think, should be the top two. And there are lots of bills related to those. I'm just going to talk about a few of them. First, House Bill 2001 allows tiny houses to be part of an affordable housing incentive program under the state's Growth Management Act. This bill passed almost unanimously and is headed for the Senate. House Bill 2097 expands the definition of first-time home buyer for the Housing Trust Fund program to include single parents who only owned a home with a former spouse, displaced homemakers who only owned a home with a spouse, individuals who only owned mobile homes, which were not on a fixed foundation, and individuals who have only owned property that has been condemned by a licensed building inspector. So this will allow a broader range of impoverished people in the state of Washington to get funding from the state for purchase of a new home as first-time home buyers. Also passing the House was House Bill 2061, adds permanently affordable housing to the list of projects that can be funded using community revitalization funds. We often think of those funds as going for local businesses, but now those funds, if this bill passes, could be used for things like affordable housing. Also passing was House Bill 1183, which sets up a home sharing support grant program and allows nonprofits who run home sharing service programs to qualify for state funding. Home sharing is when someone who owns a large home with lots of space decides that they can offer some of that space and shelter to a homeless person or family. And yes, people do that. And yes, there are nonprofits who can facilitate that. So this bill would let them qualify for state funding. Now, passing the Senate was Senate Bill 5428, which exempts temporary shelters or transitional encampments, including tent encampments, from the State Environmental Policy Act. So there would not need to be an environmental impact statement done for the setting up temporary shelters like tent encampments. Senate Bill 5607 requires the state to count homeless people who have been jailed or are in hospitals in the state's annual count of the homeless in Washington state. It acknowledges that the homeless often cycle through the criminal justice system cycle through hospitals, particularly mental health hospitals, and that they should also be included in the count of the official count of the homeless in Washington state.
What about treatment programs?
Yeah, treatment programs as well, especially if the person has not been routed to a permanent home yet. That person, if they're in a residential treatment program, it means that they're not in permanent housing and they should be counted as part of the homeless. Now, Senate Bill 5749 would require that landlords accept personal checks, cashier's checks, or money orders for rent payments, and that tenants be able to make payments by mail or at an accessible on-site location. And it prohibits landlords from requiring in a lease agreement that tenants make rent payments electronically only with no other options available. Wow. And that's very important because during COVID-19, a lot of landlords decided they were going to go electronic only because they just didn't want the hassle and cost of handling paper checks and cashier's checks and cash and so forth. So they closed their offices, would not let tenants drop off their rent payments. And they said, we want to be able to take it right out of your bank account. And yeah. That includes my own landlord said, okay, yeah, not accepting. Well. Yeah. Not accepting paper checks anymore. I want to take it right out of your bank account. And I turned around and I said, nope, I want to be able to direct the money to you when I want to pay it. And we set it up that way. But there are many tenants who are not able or not savvy enough to do that, or maybe don't have a bank account, mm-hmm. you know, and they still need a way that is convenient for them to make their rent payments. So that bill would be very, very helpful for preventing many tenants from being kicked out on the street. Now, some of the environmental bills that have passed at least one chamber include House Bill 1099. It would add the goal of climate change mitigation to the goals listed in the state's Growth Management Act, and it requires local governments to revise their growth management plans to include steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, among other environmental goals. So House Bill 1099, very important bill, and one that the state Democrats have been working on for some time. Also passing the House was House Bill 1663. It establishes a limit for the amount of methane emissions from solid waste landfills and requires the owner or operator to monitor emissions and install gas collection equipment if emissions exceed the limit. It's very important. Also, House Bill 1691 requires the owners and operators of vessels and oil facilities to get certification of financial responsibility from the state in case of an oil or fuel spill. And it adds federally recognized Native tribes as subjects who would be compensated in the event of an oil or fuel spill when calculating how much insurance or other financial bonding is needed by these owners and operators. So basically it's saying you can't just operate a vessel in the state's waters, or you can't just set up an oil storage or diesel storage facility without some kind of bonding or insurance that says you are liable financially liable or can pay claims in the event that there is a spill that damages the environment. I'm kind of surprised that that requirement is not already on the books.
I was surprised by that too, yeah.
Yeah. So, also passing the House was House Bill 1799, which sets statewide goals for composting and other organic waste treatment. And it requires certain local governments, I'm guessing there's a size limit there, to provide compost collection and treatment for their citizens. So that is a great, that would be a great statewide change. House Bill 1620, also passed the House. It requires the state to develop and implement an extreme weather response grant program to provide money for local governments to fund services during extreme weather events and high levels of wildfire smoke. The grant program would fund services like setting up warming or cooling centers, transportation to those centers, supplies to get folks off the street and into safer congregate living facilities, emergency temporary housing, and other services to protect people in times of extreme heat, extreme cold, or heavy wildfire smoke. Also passing the House is House Bill 1644. That allows school districts to spend transportation funds on electric vehicle charging stations and other zero emission fueling stations and to do feasibility studies for transitioning to zero emission student transportation. A very good bill. House Bill 1793 also passed that would forbid housing associations from banning the installation of electric vehicle charging stations as long as they're situated within an owner's unit or parking space and the owner pays 100% of the cost of installation and the electricity and the owner agrees to meet other reasonable requirements. So it would govern whether, for example, if you live in a condo complex, it would govern the condo complex would not, if this bill passes, the condo association would not be able to ban electronic vehicle charging stations altogether, but they could set reasonable requirements. Okay. Now, passing the Senate, a very important bill, Senate Bill 5842 sets up an Executive Office of Climate Policy and Accountability within the Department of Ecology to monitor and implement the state's new cap and trade program, and it makes other changes to that law. Now, there are people both for and against it within the environmental movement, and it gets a little technical. So if you're interested in environmental stuff and particularly interested in how our state cap and trade program is being set up, that's a bill to check out and read the details and keep an eye on the amendments. That's Senate Bill 5842. And then there were three other bills of note that are not housing related and not environmental related that have passed one of the two chambers. House Bill 1851 allows physician assistants and nurse practitioners to provide abortion services, and it prevents the state from penalizing any individual who gets an abortion or who helps a pregnant woman get an abortion. This bill is in response to efforts to ban abortion in places like Texas and Mississippi and other states.
And it's also in anticipation of a Supreme Court ruling.
A Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah.
Yeah. That could allow states to further restrict or ban abortion. Now,
yeah, although the right to an abortion is enshrined in the Washington State Constitution.
It is.
So we are not one of those states, but
it is, yeah.
But there are plenty of others in the midsection of the country.
Another bill of note is House Bill 1735. That's a bill that would roll back some of the police accountability gains made last year. This bill would expand police officers' ability to use physical force in the following situations: to take a mentally ill person into custody and transport them, to take a juvenile into protective custody, to arrest a person.
Wait.
Yes.
Take a juvenile into protective custody.
Custody, yes. You're allowed to grab them and subdue them.
Great. I'm sure they feel very protected.
We're here to protect you. Let me knock you to the floor, yes, and sit on you.
We're here to protect you from your abusive parent, so or guardian. Uh-huh. So let us beat you up.
Yes, we're going to put you in a pain compliance hold. Right? Okay. Another situation in which cops would be allowed to use force is when arresting a person to enforce a court order, or when executing a search warrant, or when under order by a judge or a judicial officer to use force. Okay, so it's a pretty broad selection there, and essentially, yeah, it would roll back much of what was passed last year. In addition, police officers, this bill would also allow police officers to get around the requirement to de-escalate a confrontation if it restricts their ability to, quote, perform life-saving measures or perform community caretaking functions to protect health and safety. Now, that's probably the broadest and most vaguest wording I've ever
heard. Yeah, so based on whose description of the situation?
Right, exactly. The officers, obviously. And that it, and it gets worse. And it says also that it, quote, doesn't prevent a peace officer from responding to requests for assistance or service by specified individuals and members of the public, end quote. So essentially, if someone calls anonymously and says, I want to report some guy running around naked in my, you know, on the street outside my apartment building, as long as there's a request for assistance from the public, officers don't have to de-escalate. Right? Wow. That's exactly what that means. So it really would be almost a full rollback of last year's bill to restrict when police can use force, physical force.
Do you happen to know who sponsored that bill?
I don't off the top of my head, but again, it's House Bill 1735, and you can go to leg.wa.gov, click on bill lookup and type in 1735, and it will bring up the text of the bill and details about who sponsored it, who signed on to it. Also, one other bill of note is Senate Bill 5919, which would do much of the same thing that House Bill 1735 does. But it would also restore police officers' ability to engage in car chases and vehicle pursuits. So, again, another rollback there, and another bill for people to take a look at, Senate Bill 5919. And those two bills have passed their house of origin, and so it looks like they may pass the legislature this year unless people weigh in on them. And then there is one bill that has passed both houses and been signed into law. That is HCR 4407. That's the redistricting plans for the Washington State Legislative Districts and the U.S. Congressional Districts. That passed with a majority in both houses and no amendments. So the controversial redistricting that was done did not quite make the deadline, but was finished a day or so after the deadline. That redistricting plan has passed the legislature and is now law.
All right.
So that's my wrap up of mostly housing and environmental related bills. I'll be looking at other types of bills.
And they've got until the 15th.
Yes, and they have until the 15th to pass their house of origin, and then I'll be looking at which ones pass the second house and go to the governor's desk.
Which is Tuesday. The 15th is Tuesday.
So. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. So not a whole lot more time. If there are bills that you're interested in the state legislature that have not yet passed their house of origin, now's a good time to call your representative and ask them, to move those bills along.
Yep.
All right. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to this week's COVID news.
Well, contrary to what you might have seen in the media this week, the pandemic is not over. We're still getting a couple hundred thousand new cases nationally a day and well over 1,500 deaths a day. Those numbers are going down, but not quickly enough. But you saw a succession of Democratic governors across the country lift some or all of their pandemic restrictions this week. Happily, Jay Inslee did not jump on that bandwagon. He is expected in the coming week to say when he will lift the mask mandate for indoor businesses, but he has not done so yet. California lifted a lot of their restrictions this week. So did Illinois, Michigan, Nevada lifted all of them, New Jersey, New York, and Oregon. And they're doing so. We've seen this movie before, right? Where as soon as you reach the crest of a wave and cases start to go down based on one or another variant, people declare that the pandemic is over and we can lift our restrictions now, and then the pandemic comes roaring back. And we've still got a couple more months of winter, more in places like, say, east of the Cascades, where winter lasts longer, and people stay indoors longer, et cetera, et cetera. So, the CDC came out this week and said, the Director Walensky came out this week and said, well, no, actually, this is premature. States shouldn't be lifting their restrictions just yet. We're a few weeks away from that. And as bad as the CDC's messaging has been on a number of fronts in the past few months, in this case, they're right. It is too soon. So, if you are going to an indoor space like a restaurant or a bar, particularly one that's smaller or less well ventilated, keep wearing masks because you have no idea who is and is not vaccinated. Some people check that more rigorously than others.
Well, and important to acknowledge that the Omicron variant can infect you even if you are vaccinated and boosted. Your chances are lower, but you can still get it. And you may not get symptoms, but you may pass it on to someone who is immunocompromised or is too young to be vaccinated. Those are the folks I care the most about in this pandemic are the toddlers who just have not qualified for their shots yet.
Right? Yeah. And as somebody who's immunocompromised myself, I can tell you that community of people is saying, what about us? You're just leaving us high and dry here.
Exactly.
And, they are. Absolutely. I minimize my trips out because, I have no idea who is and is not vaccinated.
That you're going to run into people who are not masked. I know. I have as well.
Yeah. you can't take a bus. You can't do a lot of things.
Yeah, and I still recommend that people get takeout or eat outdoors. There are some restaurants, it's been warm enough the last week or two. I've seen some restaurants in my neighborhood set up their outdoor tables. And
yeah, especially this weekend. It's going to be really nice this weekend.
I would be comfortable eating outdoors, and I would suggest that people get takeout and go to the park or sit at an outdoor table. Don't sit indoors in a crowded bar or restaurant. It's not time. It's not soon enough for. I mean, it's too soon for that. Okay.
Yep. Yeah. We're all tired of this pandemic. It's been a couple of long years, but just hang on a few weeks longer. And I know you heard that before too, but
I have resumed going to live theater and. But I'm going double masked, I'm vaccinated and boosted, but I don't want to get Omicron. And, I feel like if you're going to do that, if you're going to resume some semblance of normalcy, make sure it's a place you can stay masked and, wear two masks.
Yeah. And, for those folks who say, oh, well, Omicron's no big deal. It's not, it's much milder than previous variants have been. Well, that's true. But for certain people, it's been deadly, number one. And number two, I have two words, long COVID. We still have no idea, why it is that some people get long COVID, but it can be truly debilitating. It can destroy your life. It really can.
And don't forget, it's a significant number of people who experience lingering symptoms that qualify as long COVID. It's not just, maybe 1% or 2%. It's closer to 2/3.
yeah.
of people. So your chances are greater of getting long COVID if you get an infection than not, of not getting long COVID.
Yeah, and,
so it's
and,
definitely
and,
worth
and
avoiding
who,
if you can.
Yeah, and people who are totally asymptomatic for the original infection
yeah.
can still get long COVID.
Yeah, and they, you know, weeks down the line, they can go, why do I feel so bad? I didn't get infected. And then, you know, lo and behold, they have long COVID. And yes, yep. they were infected.
Yeah, they just didn't know it, so they kept spreading it.
Mm-hmm. You don't want to be one of those folks, for sure.
Nope.
And you know, people are like, oh, what's being a little tired? I'll sleep it off. I'll get over it.
It's not
and
like
I just
that.
I just have to say, you know, those are the folks who have never had a long-term chronic illness, I can tell you, because it really does affect your life. You know, when you have to wake up in the morning and ask yourself, what one or two things can I reasonably get done today among
yeah.
the dozen or so things I have to get done?
Yeah.
You know, that's like living
feeding
in
yourself
health.
Is on that list, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Feeding yourself, taking a shower. You know, that's all on that list of what one or two things can I reasonably get done today.
Yeah. Things that,
yeah.
you know,
you don't want to. Yeah. You don't want to live that way long term. That's terrible.
Yeah.
Not if you can avoid it.
So that's our little ray of sunshine for today.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I think it's perfectly fine for people to go out and really do enjoy the sunshine, even though I think this warm weather is really, really a symptom of global warming. Hey, you know, you take what you can get during this pandemic, right?
Yeah, and you take what you get during early February.
Yes.
But we didn't used to have, you know, these kind of temperatures and sunny skies in the mid-February. People who you know, are born and raised here know that this was not normal until very recently.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only going to get worse. Or better, depending on your perspective.
Exactly. If you have a James Watt perspective, then this is getting better.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we really are pretty much out of time, unless, Jav, you want to try and squeeze one subject into 1 minute.
Okay. Yeah, we haven't gotten to Ukraine or the protests in Canada yet, as well as some police accountability stuff nationally. I will say that, you know, the American government sounded the alarm yesterday and said that if they think that a Russian attack on Ukraine is likely within 48 hours. They didn't use those exact words, but that's basically what they were saying. You know, all Americans get out within 48 hours. And Russian forces basically surround Ukraine on three sides now, on the Black Sea side and on the land border, both with Russia and with Belarus, which Russia has moved some 30,000 troops into. You know, the United States is not going to send troops to Ukraine. They're sending a lot of weapons, of course. And I'm sure that makes arms manufacturers happy, but, you know, this would be a serious escalation of Russia's threat to other neighbors as well. And a land war with Ukraine has the prospect of being, very bloody, and mostly civilian death toll. The other thing to watch out for is cyber attacks, and not just cyber attacks on Ukraine, but also on NATO. Potentially on the United States. You know, there's really no predicting the situation except that it's likely to escalate in the coming days. And that is very unfortunate.
All right.
Was that succinct enough? Oh yeah. And the trucker protests in Canada that you're hearing so much about, you know, coming to the United States soon. And they're already being, heavily funded by the American right wing. And cheerled by Fox News and Republican Party figures like Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. The massive disruption on both sides of the border. Now three major border crossings are being blocked, at Detroit, at Buffalo, and in Alberta and Montana. And, I would expect something happening in Blaine soon, or actually in White Rock on the other side of the border from Blaine. Right now, a trucker convoy and protest is planned for California on March 5th. I think that's the only one that's officially been announced, but look for more of that coming up, particularly in D.C.